everyone. It is Monday, March 2nd. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. And before we begin our conversation, Ken has been gone for a week. I'm sure he has stuff to tell us about his interesting last week. But before we do that, we always begin every show with the voice of Colonel Vindman talking to Congress, assuring his father that it will be all right. We are playing Colonel Vindman's voice every single day between now and the November election. He assures his father it will be all right. I will assure our audience it will not unless we make change in November of 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. That, again, was the voice of Colonel Vindman testifying before Congress. You will hear that voice every single day on this radio show as we begin. I can't believe it is March 2nd. I can't believe that the weekend was so long and so short at the same time. But Ken has been gone for a week. So, Ken, welcome back. And fill us in a little bit about your experiences last week, because I suspect you were at the border. And you probably have lots of stories. And there are so many things to sort of thread together.
I have way too many stories, and I obviously can't tell them all. But again, it was a really moving and heart-wrenching week. It culminated the last morning. We went out at the crack of dawn, well, before dawn, to the airport because we had heard that they were going to send airplanes full of people to deport. And sure enough, we got there, we set up our little signs, and three buses arrive with deportees full of migrants, the same people that we had met in the days before in the tent camps. Mm-hmm. And the Border Patrol get out there, or the ICE guys at that point, I guess, and put shackles on each individual. They shackle them up, and then they get them to walk the plank up to the plane in shackles, and we understood that they did not even find out where they were going. They just were told to get on the buses, and get on the buses they did. They didn't know if they were going back to their home countries, which they fled from horrific violence and death and destruction, or if they were getting dumped in the middle of Guatemala woods. We were told that that's what Trump was now doing, or they didn't know where they were going. We didn't either. They're just put on the planes, and heard the story of one man that was in the news the next day who had asked when they got there whether he was going to his home country or to any other place, and he was told it wasn't his home country, and he cheered because
he didn't want to go there.
At least I'm not going to the place that I fled from where these—
Where they know me and they're actually out to kill me.
Yeah, right. Drug cartel gangs.
Yeah. Not clear whether it's legal to do a random— Yeah.
That was Ron Abramson, by the way. Yeah. He'll be joining us for our Rethink the Week. He is an immigration lawyer with Shaheen and Gordon. I just want to make sure that voice is included.
Well, how legal is it to deport these people in shackles when they're filed asylum applications?
Why does this, in a bizarre way, feel like loading people on the trains?
Absolutely.
It's just the memory of where are we going? Why are we going in shackles, not knowing where you're going next? Our level of inhumanity is just It's just overwhelming me. It's just overwhelming me.
So the first place we were, and we were watching and taking pictures, then the trucks and heavy equipment from the airport comes along and just happens to have some important business right between our line of sight and mm-hmm. where the shackled people are. So we wait a while and surreptitiously move to a different location. And guess what? Some more heavy equipment just happened to coincidentally need to do important business right between us and
right.
and what we could see is at one point there were like three layers of heavy equipment between us and where folks right. were getting on the airplane. We couldn't see much else except we knew what was behind there, and we knew that the government knew they were doing something wrong because why else would you try to block it with three levels of stuff? And the last thing we saw was the plane take off and the railroad cars going to the concentration camps.
It just feels so much. So I'm thinking of that, and then so let me bring in who's here. Dean Spiliotis will be joining us shortly. He's a presidential scholar and a civic scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. I believe Val Endres, are you there?
I'm there.
Perfect. Val Endres is a political communication professor at Rhode Island College, very much in demand in Rhode Island when it comes to talking about politics, but we are so lucky to grab her now. And of course, as I mentioned before, Ron Abramson is joining us as well. He is an immigration lawyer living in New Hampshire, and obviously the stories that he's hearing from Ken, he's just shaking his head because it's all way too familiar and too frightening. So let me just say something that I've been thinking about, and I haven't slept for a thousand reasons, but one of the reasons that we haven't actually talked about on this show, and maybe people don't talk about it all, is what's happening in Syria and to the Syrians. And the story of they have nowhere to go, and their children are freezing, and they have no support, and they have no tents, and they have no shelter. And I'm out of my mind, because you will probably see a million people die. They will freeze to death. They will freeze to death. And I am looking at this, and I'm going, oh, my God, where are we? Where are we? You know, it reminds me of what was happening with the Jews. It reminds me of what was happening with, I mean, all the genocides that we have seen and walked away from or ignored. And I was talking to a friend, and I said, you know, IKEA has these boxes that you can drop that turn into tents. And my friend is a designer, and she's made clothing that can turn into tents or can turn into, I'm like, Tom Steyer, you just left the race. Give me a couple of million dollars. Let's just drop this stuff down for them. And we don't even have time to talk about that because we're so distracted now by Wall Street and the 2020 election and COVID-19 and what's happening to the economy and the supply chains out of China. And I'm just exhausted by our inability to respond in a compassionate way. And it's not just in Syria. It's not just what's happening on the border. It's what's happening right now between each other as we face this pandemic. And a pandemic can also be, believe it or not, a good thing. We can find community in a response, or we can begin to sort of point fingers at each other and create greater alienation. There are two ways of responding. And I think about it this way, and I'll bring you in, Val, is that I remember after 9/11, I was so hoping that it would be an opportunity to self-reflect, to look back, to begin to heal, to make the requisite investments, and to respond in a way that would really be both sobering and positive. And instead, we were told to shop. We were told to shop. Oh, freaking God. And I'm looking at that, and so then I'm fast forwarding to Donald Trump, you know, basically at one point at one of his rallies talking about that the COVID-19 was a Democratic plot. It was part of a political agenda. And I'm looking at him and I'm going, what the hell are you saying? And I'm just going to end this, and then we can sort of move our conversation anywhere. But you know what's going to be interesting for Donald Trump going forward? What does Donald Trump feed on? He feeds on his rallies. He feeds on the thousands and thousands of people that congregate and wait in line for hours and hours in the cold, in the heat, in the rain, so they can be in that room of hate and lies and distortion. In comes COVID-19. COVID-19 is going to be a place where nobody wants to get online. COVID's going to be a place where nobody wants to get to a rally. COVID's going to be a place, but remember, if it's a Democratic plot, maybe you'll run the risk of believing your president that this is not a big deal and the summer it'll disappear. Or maybe for the first time, you'll believe Wall Street. You'll believe the doctors. You'll believe the scientists. You'll believe your governors. You'll believe the nurses. You'll believe the neighbor next door who's self-quarantined. All right? It is going to be so interesting to see what ultimately takes Donald Trump down. And it might be a virus. Because in the end, it points out the lies and the hypocrisy and the failure to prepare us for anything but to create an enormous amount of debt, to make the rich richer, to devastate the economy, to drain stuff out of our global health response, to not respond to the world's pandemics. All of a sudden now, all those people that have the cult of personality, they're going to have a choice. You might die by that cult of personality. This is now life and death. So I'm going to start with you, Val, and then I'm going to go to our guest. Dean Spiliotis has joined us. So, Val, we are living in such interesting times. I'm hoping that a presidential candidate can figure out a way to thread a conversation without politicizing COVID-19, but actually talking about our safety and security, and that in the end you want Donald Trump to do the right thing. But more importantly, what is the path towards the right thing? And I think that's really what the goal is of the next candidate for president. Val?
Well, I absolutely agree, but I think that the president is likely to do untold damage before then. And I was really struck. You had an article in your listing, and I urge your audience to read it, about North Korea's response to the coronavirus, where Kim Jong-un is talking about it in almost identical terms that Donald Trump used in that awful press conference that he had, and saying that we need to isolate our country, we need to close the borders because we're self-reliant. And I want to travel back to your notion about the Syrian refugees and the Syrian country, and talk about the fact that this gives us yet one more excuse not to take in refugees, to close our border, and to be isolated, and who's to say that he doesn't do this on a statewide basis? That
isolate the state of Washington. It's too liberal
that's
anyway.
Right.
Isolate California.
And there isn't a time when we really need, and of course you've talked about this before, we need a level-headed person that we can trust to be able to talk about this. And the problem is, probably our worst problem right now, is that we are in the middle of a presidential race. Mm-hmm. So all of this gets politicized.
Right.
And that makes it all the more difficult for people to sort this through. And I truly believe that we're on our own for right now.
Mm-hmm. So I want to reference the article. So if those of you are following and don't happen to go to the my Facebook page for The Attitude, it's from The Hill. It's from today. It's from February 29th. Kim Jong-un warns of serious consequences if coronavirus hits North Korea. And I think I'm correct here. They could close up their borders, but they are very dependent on other countries in order to survive. They can't close their borders.
Specifically China.
Exactly. Totally. And which is ironic given the fact that China right now is still the epicenter of this virus. So,
well, on both sides, in South Korea, too.
Exactly. So, Ron, as I'm thinking about this, I did something totally ridiculous this morning. Because
shocker.
I know, shocking, that now that I know that there's such an incredible Trump has this incredible truth deficit, so nobody trusts him, a trust deficit. He then takes his aide de camp, Vice President Pence, you know, the man who genuflects to the Trump golden chair, and makes him in charge of the response to COVID-19 against someone we don't trust, especially given his behavior as governor in Indiana. And we know what he did there. He probably caused more deaths there as well when he was challenged by a much smaller scale crisis of similar ilk. And I said something. So I Googled, who is the most trusted, respected politicians in America? Okay, former, current, whatever. And I decided I didn't want someone in the 2020 campaign. So I pulled that one out of the box. Here's the order. It is Obama, it is Carter, and it is Arnold Schwarzenegger, believe it or not. And I thought, wow. And I thought, isn't this interesting? What if Trump made a decision to replace Vice President Pence with Obama? And say, I want him to be in charge of but I'm saying it for a lot of, no, don't look, everyone's shaking their heads.
We're all walking out.
We suddenly jumped into a parallel universe.
We'll see you next week, people.
Right, they're all taking
off. Arnie's lost your mind.
No. I haven't lost my mind.
Sorry.
And the reason I haven't lost my mind is that in a bizarre way,
it is bizarre.
It's no, but it speaks to the problem of the moment. that in a lot of ways it is about the hole that is so enormous when it comes to trust, the inability to get actual guidance, even if we're getting something in the way of guidance from the scientists and the doctors, because finally he may be putting them forward, you're not sure that he's putting in the requisite support system because he's so drained the system, that by even mentioning Obama, not only do I make him apoplectic, but I speak to both our past Obama and our future, which is not Trump, that in the end, this is the trust hole, and we have to replace it with something else.
Yeah, right, I will so tell you something. And we all know that's not going to happen.
I know, but it would be interesting.
But I understand your point in theory.
Right.
I will say this. I watched, I think it was yesterday, although I'm losing track of time. They had the press conference in the briefing room with Trump and Pence and CDC ahead and Anthony Fauci as well. Trump just has real difficulty explaining this stuff. And the problem he has with the media is we know he's very sensitive to criticism. He focuses more on the tone and word choice of the question than he does on conveying information. But I would tell you this.
Very good point.
As soon as Pence started talking, or Fauci or the head of CDC, it was like a million times better. If they just took Trump out of that press conference and let everybody else talk, that would be an improvement in terms of trust level. Because Trump just kind of his nature, he can't help it. He kind of derails the transfer of information. Now, you know, Pence has been criticized for what happened in Indiana, and he certainly has thrown himself into this with both feet. We'll see what happens. But it was interesting. I remember turning to my wife, who was sitting next to me, and I said, if they just took Trump out of the press conference, the level of trust in what the government was saying would have been 50% higher at a minimum, because everybody else could talk clearly, complete sentences, not bite back at the journalist because they don't like the word choice or the tone of the question.
Right.
It was a remarkable thing to me to see.
Well, yes,
if the issue is trust.
And Ron, I posted just too many articles, but one of the articles I think is so interesting is the key missteps of the CDC have set us back our ability to detect the potential spread of coronavirus. And in a lot of ways, the missteps in part reflect the draining of institutional memory, the draining of support, the draining of our ability to respond to the global pandemics as they were occurring other places, because the best way to protect your country is to help eradicate it around the world, since we are a hub for so much when it comes to transportation and the economy and everything else. Ron.
Just breathing for a second.
Okay.
After all that.
Okay.
But I'm not wearing a mask, so the listeners at home know that.
Okay.
No one's wearing a mask in here. This is an exposition of everything that's wrong with this administration.
Yes.
From the very beginning until this point. And you mentioned how we can't have more sympathy, empathy, compassion for each other. If we had more of that, we wouldn't necessarily be in this situation. And what we have is a set of systems that were supposed to provide safeguards for these sorts of things to some extent that have been knocked out. I think 37 of 47 relevant public health programs have been eliminated by this administration. And then you have an administration that is constitutionally, and I choose that word on purpose, but I don't mean it in the legal sense, constitutionally incapable of ever admitting any mistakes.
Yeah.
And so the lack of self-reflection and contrition just means they double down on any bad decision. And I tweeted at some point last week, given the choice between saving face and saving lives, what would this president choose?
Exactly. And here's the interesting thing. So since he doesn't believe the scientists, there is one thing he does believe. And he's trying to control it, but he can't. And that is the markets. And the markets now have abandoned him as well. And I love this line. I actually heard it on MSNBC this morning, but I just want everyone to know I quoted it last week, so I'm ahead of them. And it was a Federal Reserve chief. And the head of one of the Federal Reserves in one of the, I don't know, St. Louis, I think it was, was saying, here's the problem with the Federal Reserve and with, what you expect bankers to do. They can't come up with a vaccine for the coronavirus. We can do a lot of things, but we can't make vaccines. And I think that really speaks volumes about the scientists, about the healthcare system. But Val, the other thing that I saw this morning, and I think I may have mentioned this, is that Schumer said that we should completely cover the cost for any coronavirus testing, that it should not cost anyone anything. So I posted that, which I think it's a very good idea, after that guy was told he was going to be charged $3,000 for a coronavirus test. So here's my question. If you are an undocumented immigrant, are we going to include the free testing for them as well? That's my first question, Val. And after I get the finding that I have coronavirus, will you help me with my COBRA, my copay, my deductible, my out of network, my no free time to take off time when I'm sick? I mean, in a lot of ways, I wanted Schumer to sort of offer that at the beginning of the conversation, but that to remind people, it still leaves us with lots of incredible medical holes.
Well, and the one thing that a pandemic will do is connect us together, and now we're back to our healthcare system where we've let the underserved cope on their own. And, you know, for example, we can see that there's been the lack of Medicaid expansion in the way that it should have been, following Obamacare. We see that rural hospitals are understaffed and undersupplied. And mostly that's where the underserved are going, is to the rural hospitals that sometimes they have to drive 200 miles to even get to see a primary care physician. But the problem with this is you can't isolate the illness. And so the underserved, and we haven't even begun to think about the homeless, for example, and to think about pockets of people who are left very vulnerable to this disease and no means to help them to control it or to isolate themselves. And even the working poor, for example, most states or many states don't have sick leave. In Rhode Island, we just passed a sick leave bill last year, but it's only for 5 days. And what do you do about people who are in the restaurant industry and the fast food industry and people like CNAs who are dealing constantly with patients but can't take the time off and thus infect other people? So this whole notion about income inequality is coming back to bite us if this truly turns into a pandemic.
Okay, Rod, then Dean.
Well, and it just broke this weekend that the Supreme Court is taking up the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act, which means we'll probably get a decision sometime by the fall.
They said it's probably going to be
heard
around.
In the fall.
Yeah, it'll be around after 2020.
After the election. Yeah. But now the Affordable Care Act, which is the most basic hanging by a thread safety net in terms of our ability to cover people in this situation and in general when it comes to health care, is possibly on its last legs.
Yeah, and the Trump administration supports that particular challenge.
Correct.
Well,
yeah.
Which we should need to remind people over and over and over again. And so, Dean, as I'm listening to this conversation, I mentioned, so undocumented immigrants, will they be able to access, you know, these free coronavirus testing, number one? Number two, there are 600,000 undocumented immigrants in Houston alone. And if they get sick, where do they go? Not only was there no Medicaid expansion in Texas, not only does Texas have the highest number of uninsured, not only does Texas have one of the biggest problems with their rural hospitals because
of this,
but now we have a situation where there is such a mixing of populations of all kinds in Texas. And this is really a come-to-Jesus moment for places like Texas, not just about, you know, their governor, but in fact about who they elect as president, because if there's a level of vulnerability from COVID-19, it is in places where there are large pockets of people who feel frightened about using services, who told and targeted, you know, by ICE that you shouldn't use services, where you have in the city of, I think it is Boston, where ICE is coming into Massachusetts in order to sort of do these SWAT teams because they don't like these sanctuary cities. It's going to be a real challenge on so many issues that Donald Trump has basically made his flagship.
Yeah, and you have heard some talk about these, that there may be this communal spread in groups like the – I saw an article about the homeless population in Los Angeles or other areas where undocumented workers may be afraid to actually come forward and ask for some sort of medical treatment. You know, I will say I don't know – I mean, I'm sure some people are going to fall through the cracks. That's inevitable, I think. I just heard right before I came in here that the Congress is close to about a $7 billion agreement on this, which is way more. I think Trump asked for $2.5 billion. So Congress is now going to come back with about $7 billion. And I also saw that they're preparing potentially to be able to declare a national emergency, which also ramp up resources and funding. So there, down the road, there may be opportunities for people to get these tests done freely. The counterbalance to that is I heard a clip on the news a few minutes ago I think it was an ER doc in one of the busiest hospitals in New York City who said, you know, I'm treating sick people all day and I have no instant test that I can give them if they're running a fever. I used to have to call the CDC. Now I have to call the New York State Department of Health. So that's an improvement, but it's still not like
closer.
You just can't just do like a quick test and have a result. So
we
may be headed that way, but it's really uncertain.
And last but not least, my daughter lives in China, so I need to let everyone know I hear from her 3 times a day. Okay, maybe this is not such a good thing, but anyway, I do. Mm-hmm. And so this morning's conversation, which means it's at night, is that today was the first day, Monday was the first day that they opened up back for school and for business in Shanghai. And everyone is on pins and needles. Up until then, nobody has been going to work. The streets of Shanghai have been empty. She is tested the minute she walks out of her apartment complex. They have locked doors. She's tested when she walks into the grocery stores. That's with nobody working and nobody going to school. Whether they can maintain that level of testing and oversight, you're tested every person who goes into the subway is tested for fever. They have a way where you step on this piece of equipment and everyone before they go into the subway is tested for fever. That is in control authoritarian China.
Right.
That's what they're getting to do. I just want to sober everything up. Imagine anything even close to that being possible in the United States. And on that note, we're going to have a little labor history. This is the Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Artisan. Be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1990. That was the day 9,300 workers walked out at Greyhound bus lines. The 1980s devastated Greyhound workers. First, the industry had been rocked by President Carter's deregulation of the transportation industry. Then, a bitter 1983 strike ended in defeat for the workers. Concessionary contracts, deep wage cuts, and a two-tier wage system were firmly established by the time contract negotiations started in early 1990. The Amalgamated Transit Union negotiated terms closer to what was lost over the past decade. But the new owners at Greyhound would have none of it. They claimed $300 million in debt. The ATU insisted the company had been turning a handsome profit. Pickets went up at depots and garages around the country, while hundreds of scab drivers were hired. With a week's worth of training, they were soon operating 10-ton buses unsafely. Riders complained of replacement drivers falling asleep at the wheel. The strike soon turned violent and deadly. There were reports of sniper fire and bomb threats. Many charged that these were fake stories meant to spike public support for the strike. Early on, 59-year-old Robert Waterhouse was run down by a scab driver while on the picket line in Redding, California. Waterhouse had 30 years as a driver with the company and had planned his retirement for that summer when he was killed. ATU reported many more picket line injuries. Within a month, the company was operating with 2,400 replacement drivers. The company filed for bankruptcy in June. After 3 years, they would finally agree to $22 million in back pay, reinstate hundreds of drivers, and raise wages. But the number of drivers was cut in half. It would take the ATU years to rebuild its strength.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2018, the city of St. Louis Park, Minnesota, made the commitment to become carbon neutral. The decision was the result of pressure from local high school students.
They felt passionate, like a lot of youth around the country do, that there's an urgency. And so they brought that urgency to their city council in the form of letters, in the form of presentations. They went and spoke at the city council and to their elected officials and just kept drilling home this message of, this is our home too, right?
Jesse White is with the Great Plains Institute. The group helped the city write a climate action plan that addressed the students' concerns. After it passed, the Institute kept the youth engaged.
We wanted to leverage these students whose voices were so powerful and who had this passion.
The group gave the students data about the suitability of each rooftop in the city for solar panels. Then the teens went door to door. They talked to people about the solar energy their roof could generate and how to finance solar panels. Ultimately, Wyatt says that effort will lead to at least 7 new solar installations. She says the teens' knowledge and energy were amazing.
These students are intelligent, they're smart, they know climate, and they're our future leaders. We can hand off the baton with confidence that the next generation knows what they're doing.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Bernie, I'm impressed with his influential friends. He's got very big connections, and I follow his directions. Bernie knows his way around, and so I always do what Bernie recommends. I am blessed with my attorney Bernie. I'm impressed with the way he runs the store. He's got Dodger season boxes and an office full of foxes. It's amazing all the different things your average guy might need a lawyer for. Bernie tells me what to do. Bernie lays it on the line. Bernie says we sue, we sue. Bernie says we sign, we sign.
Oh, do I love it. Too bad Bernie wasn't a lawyer. He would love that song. That's right. I got boxes full of foxes. Actually, I don't know. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and Ken Barnes of Pixar Music. Who sings My Attorney Bernie?
Well, that's My Attorney Bernie by David Frischberg. And I don't know. For some reason, I thought something about Bernie might be relevant today.
We need something light. All right. Joining us for our Rethink the Week in studio, immigration attorney Ron Abramson with Shaheen and Gordon, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar and presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. Joining us by phone is Val Endres. She is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. I want to start here. So, Ron, I want to talk about not just Bernie. I'm going to do the four B's. Bernie, Biden, Buttigieg, and, of course, Bloomberg. So let's start with actually in the order of events. Let's start with Biden. So Biden completely surprised everyone with a almost 30-point lead. I mean, it was just he cleaned everyone's clock. It was remarkable. I did a show this morning in New York City, and I said, you know, it's just so amazing because this is his first win in four tries for president. I just want everyone to know that, you know, since Ronald Reagan, I believe it was, he's been running for president on and off since then. And so, but what is so fascinating for me is that he's had an uneven performance up until what happened the other day. And yet what—
Uneven is kind.
Okay, I'll be good. And but I'm trying to be nice. So he has an uneven performance, Ron, but what's interesting is that the reason why he was able to deliver in South Carolina is for two reasons. And I said he's bookended by two individuals, Barack Obama and Congressman Clyburn. And but for Obama and Clyburn, we would still be in this sort of interesting place. And if it was just Obama, we would still be in it. So in some ways, in order for Biden to succeed, he needs these buoys. The question is, how do you continue throughout the rest of the campaign, and who are your next buoys? So anyway, Ron.
Well, we're going to know a lot more, hopefully, by the end of the night tomorrow, after 14 states. And is it Guam go to the polls?
Guam.
So American Samoa?
Samoa.
Yeah, American Samoa, yep.
It's always good to have a political science professor in the room.
That's right.
So
one of those territories. All right,
but I found it interesting that one victory for Joe Biden in a state where he's got deep connections, deep roots, and as you said, had important support. And not to take anything away from him. I mean, he has built and nurtured those relationships for 30-something years, and they came to the polls for him. That's fine. That's how some of this process works. I mean, he's been running for president longer than Pete Buttigieg has been alive, or pretty close. So it seems like a bit of an anomalous result, yet also seemed to cast the race in a very significant way with Buttigieg dropping out and the centrist support coalescing around Biden after just this one victory, which turned out to be, as I think you said, his first primary victory
ever.
In his life.
Ever.
And I mean, maybe the lesson is never give up to all of us. But
he kind of said that during his speech, actually.
Right.
It was a beautiful speech, by the way. I'm so glad that he read the teleprompter well and they mm-hmm. heard his – they had his voice.
Right.
His voice when he's coherent. And,
yeah.
and there are times that you need a GPS to follow what he's saying. But when he's on message and he's following, there is an empathy thing, Dean, that I heard Mayor Pete – let me just be honest with you. I heard Mayor Pete and I heard Biden. And I actually started to sort of weep a little. And the reason I was weeping a little, Dean, was because they know how to find that empathy voice. They do that so incredibly well. And I was trying to figure out, have I ever heard that from Bernie? Have I ever heard an empathy? I mean, does he even know what it sounds like? How could he deliver that? And there is something really reassuring at a time of so much emotional unrest and so much fear that you need someone who can sort of soothe your brow. And that's a little bit what I heard from Pete and from Biden. But let me go back to Biden before we sort of continue the conversation somewhere else. And that is that so – Biden has done well, but you know why Biden is going in even more powerfully into the Tuesday race? Because he's creating some opportunity that we saw with Donald Trump. And here's what Donald Trump got. Donald Trump got more free media in order to win the presidency in 2016
yes.
than any human being in human history.
Yes.
I believe it was $2 billion, Dean Spiliotis. Mm-hmm. If you look at the response to his win that we all are kind of sober about and impressed with, the amount of free media, because he can't afford it because he doesn't have a campaign and he doesn't have people on the ground and he doesn't have money in his coffers and he's had a weak campaign until, you know, basically over the weekend on Saturday, he has probably gotten maybe $500 million in free media from that weekend. And that's a lot. And despite the fact that Bloomberg can spend $500 million, he can't compete with what Biden did, which was actual numbers and then an enormous, enormous cloud of remarkable sort of free embrace that he got on CNN, on MSNBC, even on Fox, I think he got it. So I'm just kind of
confused. Biden you're talking
about. I'm talking about Biden. So it's just so interesting. So I want the media to understand that they are also sort of creating this possible result, not because Biden did it without them.
No denying that. It was very clear to me watching the coverage Sunday and today that certain media outlets were very eager to write the Biden comeback story, almost giddy to write the Biden
giddy,
comeback
that's
story.
That's the word, giddy.
He's got a tremendous amount of free media. You know, as Ron said, we don't really know whether this is an outlier or not. You know, the kind of elite signaling we saw from Jim Clyburn, as political scientists like to call it, that can be useful. You know, we're now starting to see some other senior members of Congress start to endorse him.
Tim Kaine in Virginia.
Yeah, people were just looking for something to be enthusiastic about, some sign of life from Biden. And, you know, he was clearly, when you saw his victory speech,
beautiful.
It was a different guy. I mean, he was energized, you know,
beautiful.
Glimmers of the old, you know, go get him, Joe kind of personality.
Right.
But you know, Bernie's got a tremendous organization in a lot of the states. We may end up with some kind of bifurcated result where Bernie does better out west than in the center of the country, and Joe kind of sweeps the south because the African-American population will support him strongly. We don't know. You know, part of the I think part of the game now, because you got Bloomberg, Elizabeth Warren is mm-hmm. still in as far as we mm-hmm. know, Amy Klobuchar, is – you know, you're already hearing game like, well, if some of those folks can all get over 15% to be viable in the –
they're going to stay.
They'll stay in, mm-hmm. right. and that deprives Sanders of delegates. And so the goal becomes not so much to immediately go to a two-person race with Biden and Sanders, get there eventually, but in the meantime, keep Sanders close by having these other candidates get 17%.
Let me grab Val, because I want to go into two other things, which I think is so interesting. And actually, it's Bloomberg and Buttigieg at the same time. So you heard that Bloomberg had bought 3 minutes on the major TV stations in the country at the same time. So in a lot of ways, he was going to give his State of the Union
mini
address.
Mini State of the Union
For Mini Mike. He was going to give his mini State of the Union before he got elected. This is the warm-up State of the Union. What I thought was damn brilliant of Mayor Pete was that he stepped all over it. Because just as people were thinking, okay, I'm going to go watch this Bloomberg 3 minutes, basically Mayor Pete came out and, of course, gave this incredibly emotional, eloquent speech. And he did it in such a way that Bloomberg disappeared into the distance and all the money he spent on that 3 minutes went poof, goodbye. But, you know, who cares? He's got that under the couch anyway. But I think that Mayor Pete did something brilliant on two levels. Not only did he step out at the right time, and he stepped out right after Biden had won and right about the time that Bloomberg was going to give that mini State of the Union. But you know what? He had nothing to lose. See, Amy has Minnesota. Elizabeth Warren has Massachusetts. Actually, Pete has nothing.
And California.
And California. Pete has nothing. So he has nothing to lose. He's only 38. He's got his youth. He gave bouquets to the DNC. He gave bouquets to Biden. He sent bouquets to everyone who wants the moderate candidate. So he was, it looks like it was a sacrifice, but in a lot of ways it was brilliant, brilliant tactics, again, showing his smarts as he's looking not only to 24 or 28, but to maybe what position he wants in a Biden administration.
Well, I have a couple of responses. One is I'm not sure that was Mayor Pete's motive for cutting into Bloomberg, but it certainly was effective to do so.
Picked the time. He picked the time. Everyone has known for 48 hours how long that Bloomberg was buying this time. He picked the time. He could have done it at 7:30. He could have done it at 9.
I'm not sure that that's substantially going to cut into Bloomberg, and I'll explain that in a minute. But also, you know, I'm reminded of the fact that Biden is now the youngest man in the race, and we could look back and see that if Mayor Pete has until 2060 to run for the presidency, and he will still be younger than the three B's.
Wow.
And so you want to think about it, he's got 40 years ahead of him to run. Yeah. So it was a very wise thing for him to do. It would set him nicely if it was a Biden presidency to perhaps run the DNC or be in the cabinet. But I want to go back to the Bloomberg factor, and that is, we have to look and see what happens in Super Tuesday, because one of the things that Bloomberg has been able to do that particularly Biden has not, because of his lack of fundraising skills, is that Bloomberg has been buying into expensive media markets, and particularly in California, in Texas, and some of the larger states where other candidates haven't been able to do so. And it really does depend on which Bloomberg the population is looking at. Are they looking at the Bloomberg in the debates, or are they looking at that confident, very stylized Bloomberg from the ads? So this really will be a test on whether that $500 million was spent wisely. So I don't want to count or discount Bloomberg's as a factor in Super Tuesday, because we just don't know what the impact of those ads is going to be.
And I want to go back to the unevenness of I want to go back to the unevenness of Biden in the past. And again, I'm asking, who's his next Clyburn? Okay, that's kind of the question after Super Tuesday, and maybe he will benefit from Super Tuesday. Bloomberg can go the distance, you know, and he knows it. And what I think Bloomberg has going for him is not only does he kind of know how uneven Biden has been. His campaign staff is very aware of that. But he has actually something that's actually going to help him a lot with COVID-19. And it's not that it's the pandemic healthcare piece. It's the economy piece. Because of Bloomberg News, because of Wall Street, because people are seeing the economy so, so fragile right now because of supply chains.
That's right.
He comes to the table, Ron Abramson, with not only incredible knowledge of this, but with incredible credibility that, frankly, Biden doesn't have, Trump doesn't have, Bernie doesn't have. So there's a piece here that we have to look at and, again, be sober about what are his assets. Yes, Ron.
Well, a couple things. One is there's been a slight test case, and we haven't talked about it yet, and that is that Tom Steyer dropped out after putting in $250,000 or more of his own fortune $250 million.
A quarter billion,
right, of his own fortune, and got some traction, just not enough to be viable. And Bloomberg has that quality where it seems like the more he is out front and center, the more his numbers drop. His advertising is very slick and very well, mm-hmm. very well designed, but his two debate performances, one was catastrophic, one was just quite poor, and he hasn't really engendered any trust. And you know, the other question, I mean, you just brought up a very fair point, but you know, it may be time to consider, although he's a different kind of businessman, that having a businessman run the government is not really the way to make a country prosper. We are not a business.
Right. And let me turn to you, Dean, and I want to sort of challenge you a little bit about those. And that is that Bloomberg understands he doesn't perform well in debates. Maybe Tom Steyer's big weakness was he actually started out a year and a half ago or a year ago and participated mm-hmm. like everybody else and played by the rules and got screwed by the rules in some ways because it didn't necessarily help him. Plus, he could only buy one state at a time where Bloomberg has the capacity to buy all 50 because he's got $62 billion, you know, whatever. But Dean,
I call Steyer the billionaire next door.
The billionaire next door, exactly. The billionaire.
Mini billionaire.
Yeah, the mini billionaire. But Dean, as I'm looking at Bloomberg, Bloomberg is actually saying, all right, I'm not a good debater. I'll give you that. Okay, and I'm going to start with that. But in the end, is this really about debate style or is this about delivery? And, of course, he can say that he's been more than a businessman, Dean, because he was mayor of New York for 12 years right after 9/11. And everyone remembers, you know, the country's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. Thank God he did leave. But what is the challenge isn't to be only stable on the day of 9/11. It's to be able to restore stability to one of the major, major economic hubs in the world, and that was New York. So I think in an interesting way, the fact that he doesn't do well in debates may not be that liability, Dean, that people are suggesting.
Yeah, I thought a little bit about this, trying to figure out how he's playing with voters in terms of, you know, how he's appealing to them. And, you know, he is now repeating the line, we're not voting for a debater in chief.
There you go.
That's his main line on the stump. And what I will say is he, more than any other candidate by far, makes the case that the presidency is all about managerial experience, that he is a top-line manager with tremendous experience, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You look at how we elect presidents and who gets elected, it's typically not people who have focused on a message of managerial excellence. It's people who are, you know, who are transcendent in some way, who inspire hope or fear, who connect with us emotionally. So for me, this is a really interesting test case because his best argument is I am the best manager.
I am the best manager.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And that's not how people vote for presidents, for better or worse. And so were he to win, I mean, this is kind of like, I'm not going to compare him directly to Dukakis, but Dukakis had a similar kind of managerial excellence mm-hmm. technocrat mm-hmm. kind of argument. You know, not that HW was the most transcendent figure, but typically presidential candidates who succeed connect on an emotional level. And that's not something he really is strong at.
Ken?
Well, I just want to add a slightly different perspective, and I apologize for her name not beginning with a B.
But, Warren, I agree.
I think Elizabeth Warren really needs to be thought about and discussed and considered more.
Yep.
Because, you know, everybody's looking for an alternative to the big bad Bernie. And Elizabeth could easily, if she can stay in the race, and wait until it comes down to a convention where Bernie has the lead, maybe, and other people are in it. And she's got an appeal to all of the people who like Bernie's policies because her policies are very progressive.
Mm-hmm.
She's got managerial planning chops, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. tells you how she's going to get things done, and she actually, you know, they're based in
fact. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is like the queen of all these things.
Absolutely. And she's a person who doesn't turn people off the way Bernie does. And so you talk about somebody who can give you a calming feeling that, you know, mm-hmm. I'm going to run the country. I'm going to run it well. You can trust me because I know what I'm doing. And I'm not going to be out there shouting at people.
So I have to ask Val the question. So how will the population base at large deal with someone who comes in with clearly third place, not Bernie, not Biden, but Elizabeth, and we end up with this brokered convention, and then the third place finisher is the one that they choose. And well, I'm just trying to figure out how you do this and do it in such a way that you sort of keep people together, which is the whole point, the Velcro, and you all, you know, I mean, it's like, it's not about the numbers because she's third. It's not, I mean, it's like, ugh. So I'm just kind of trying to, can you like hold my hand and explain to me how this happens?
Well, you were talking about whether Bloomberg could win, and Bloomberg doesn't need to win. He just needs to disrupt. And so we're looking at, can somebody get to the 1900 plus threshold? And if we look at it from that perspective, Warren last night came out with her plan on how she is going to prevail. And so she's looking at, for example, that she understands that she may not win any states, including Massachusetts, but she'll collect delegates. And she thinks she'll be second in five states, and she'll be in the top three in the 14 states for Super Tuesday. I think that's awfully optimistic. But if we're talking about the lead exchanging hands, and Bloomberg is disrupting as well, changing hands between Bernie and Biden, the delegates or the superdelegates may very well look, and this is sort of like ranked choice. And look at it and say, but there's the slow and steady Warren here, who's been able to be in the top three in most of the states and number two in other states, and I think she starts to look more viable.
Actually, so Ron, I'm thinking of this. Of course, ranked choice voting is like screaming in my head as we're talking, okay? And it would be a lot of ways of explaining to people what is ranked choice voting. And that ranked choice voting is actually a good thing for this reason. It is about the best of compromise. It's about saying that, you know what, maybe I don't get my choice, but can I get a choice that I can agree with my neighbor? Can I find consensus with my neighbor? And in a way, what she is saying is, I am not only the personification of ranked choice voting in this Democratic convention, I am the personification of the kinds of compromises we make to ensure that we not only provide the leadership, but we provide the ability to defeat Donald Trump. And it's not going to be a switch on off. It is going to be a series of political negotiations and conversations and discussions, and I actually embody that. What do you think, Ron?
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that Elizabeth Warren, full disclosure, with whom I was very actively involved during the New Hampshire primary, she's had a similar competence and substantive approach to her campaign for the last year, and it just has not gotten the traction, going back to what Dean was saying, that you know, you would think that if nothing else in this particular moment in our history, competence would be a huge selling point. And the ability to understand what's wrong, address it. She's the only candidate who's promoted corruption, anti-corruption, as a front and center part of her approach to inhabiting the Oval Office. And it's just not getting the traction because people want more comfort. People want more
emotional appeal. Debate on top of it.
But I'm going to mirror what you just said, Dean Spiliotis, about Bloomberg and competence. So you've got the two competent candidates, very different. In so many ways. I mean, the billionaire and the anti-billionaire. I mean, that's really what they are. Both of them using the competence line. But in the end, it's not just competence. It isn't just even empathy. It's political skills. And I have said now for weeks, if not months, that what Elizabeth lacks is political skills. And the reason I say that over and over again is that, for example, when she took Bloomberg out on that debate stage and did an amazing job, all right, that was the old Elizabeth who took on Wall Street and created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I had not seen that Elizabeth throughout virtually her whole campaign. I had a plan for that, but she didn't have a plan for this, okay? And I was wondering that night that where did that voice go, and is there time to replicate that voice going forward? And that is political skills. That's not competency skills, Dean Spiliotis. No. And we have to recognize that there is a marriage of both in order to become president of the United States. You can buy New York City. You can buy San Francisco. You can buy Detroit. But you can't just have competency and money. You need something else. And that's really, yeah, I think, what's part, missing from those two.
Part of that is trusting your instincts. If you're somebody who has political skills, it's often the case that the candidates, you get kind of, you know, you're in these constant, like, strategy discussions with your campaign staff and outside advisors trying to give you advice on what to do. And you can get kind of lost. I mean, what's really been fascinating to me was – you know, there was all this criticism of Elizabeth Warren for being like Bernie, like completely unrealistic about getting these things actually legislated and put in place. So she said, okay,
I'll be realistic.
I'll be realistic. And she got pummeled for it. Whereas Bernie has not given an inch, and it has not hurt him whatsoever. And so it's just fascinating to me. I mean, for whatever reason, that what was seemed like a perfectly reasonable thing to do strategically just blew up on her, and she has not recovered from that.
So, Val, I'm going to end this way, and I said this on a radio show in New York City this morning, and I said, here's the problem. In a lot of ways, it's, again, her political skills. What Elizabeth Warren should have said is that the conversation, for example, with the moderate Democrats and the Republicans is that center is to the right. That's where we find center, because they get sucked down towards the right of the spectrum. With me and Bernie, okay, what you get is a full spectrum. And when there is compromise at the end, not at the beginning, you get something that is to the left of center that moves us in the direction of, you know, Medicare for all, Green New Deal. But if you compromise coming out of the box, we accomplish nothing at a time of urgency that we need to accomplish. She has never said that. She did somehow say, oh, here's the math and here's the taxes. That wasn't the answer, Val. The answer was what I just said, which is, let me tell you how we get there, but let me tell you why our voice and our vision is essential if you ever want to get there.
I don't disagree with you at all about that, and I agree that we should have probably have had the old Elizabeth Warren and have her fight and have her punch back, as we've seen in the last two debates. But I'm also going to argue that she's being judged much more harshly because of the gender issue there. And because, you know, the headline became that Elizabeth Warren couldn't answer the question competently.
Right.
And she answered it competently later on. Mm-hmm. But does that really, is that seen as an egregious fault when we look at political skill and the mistakes that Joe Biden makes?
Yeah.
Exactly. They've been propping up Joe. Oh, my God. What is it? I hear dead people. That's all I keep thinking about. And on that note, it is Rethink the Week. Dean Spiliotis, Ron Abramson, Ken Barnes, Val Endres, thank you so much for joining us. And we end with what song?
This Land Is Your Land.
How we needed that.
Positive.
Yes. Thank you, Arlo Guthrie.
As I went walking the ribbon of highway, I saw above me an endless skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. This land was made for you and me. Help us out. This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York. As the sun was shining and I went strolling, the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the fog was lifting as a voice was chanting, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking, I saw a sign.